Hi, my name is Dwayne Hendricks, and I haven't given a talk sitting down for some time, so this will be new for me. What I want to do here is talk about some work that I've been doing. You see the title of the talk is On the Road to a Gigabit. My state, where I live in California, the state of California, we have a initiative to bring gigabit connectivity to everybody in the state. That means wired and wireless by 2010. So I'm going to talk about this, but the approach I'm going to take is a little bit circular in that I'm going to do this in sort of like a detective story. If any of you are familiar with James Burke and the Connection series that first aired on BBC, I always try to do this in my talks and sort of like talk about the history of something before I get into the current meat, because it gives you a context to try to evaluate what I'm going to talk about. Because if you're going to talk about a gigabit, then what does that a gigabit probably doesn't mean anything to any of you at all, really, in terms of what you would do with that bandwidth. Well, I'm going to show you what you can do with that bandwidth, okay? So, if you go back before the 1830s, the fastest way man could communicate was the speed of the fastest animal or the time it took for a wind-driven ship to cross the ocean. That changed with the advent of the telegraph. But first, I want to introduce a premise. Again, this is like the connections approach of James Burke, which is that first comes the technology, and then as time passes, it becomes more accessible. So remember this, because I'm going to go back to it several times in this talk. So with the telegraph, man went from foot speed to light speed, just like that. And we've had it easy because in our generation, we basically had light speed to deal with from the time we were born. But back in the 19th century, when the telegraph came about, people hit a wall very quickly on this because it was a tremendous change to the culture and society at the time. It's hard for us to really look back and think about what this meant from going from foot speed to light speed, but if you look at the writings of the time, and historians have done, there's a great book called The Victorian Internet, okay, by a guy named Tom Standage that really talks about this, and it's a quick read. I really encourage people to go and look at it. But anyway, here's an early wireheaded telegrapher, okay, and I'll use this wirehead term, but let's jump to Marconi, the end of the 19th century. And what Marconi did was build on the work of Maxwell and Hertz to build working wireless devices. So his first milestone was in 1901, getting a signal across the Atlantic, and starting commercial service in 1903. So we just passed the centenary, the 100-year of Marconi's commercial service. And this is very important because there's another big event that happened in 1903, which we just celebrated, which is the Wright brothers. I'll get into that. But if you look at the wireless heads, that technology was basically reduced to practice and installed in a lot of places in a very short period of time. So from 1903 to about 1908, you had it being installed at a lot of ships at sea. So at the time, the spectrum was treated as an open commons, okay, which is important because what happened with the Titanic disaster was that this was the impetus for a lot of people that didn't like that commons approach to change things to a property model. So the Titanic disaster had a tremendous impact, and that it resulted in globally a move by governments to move the spectrum into a property regime. And in my country, it resulted in the formation of the FCC in 1934, where the Communications Act of 34 basically put spectrum into that kind of regimen. So today, what I want to do is jump to the period of about 1980, and I want to talk about how unlicensed communications got started. It started in my country, and it started with the FCC, our government, taking a proactive move. Now, this is very, very significant, because usually regulatory matters revolving around the FCC are somebody submits a petition for rulemaking to the commission, and then they go through a jabber-jabber and act on it, you know, and it takes years. Here is an instance where the government itself, the FCC, said, look, we're going to change the way we manage spectrum and our philosophy of doing spectrum management. Because at the end of the 1970s, the government had run out of spectrum, given the technology that was at hand, had run out of spectrum to allocate. So it was in a spectrum crisis. So the government realized unless they changed the paradigm, nothing new could happen. Okay? So some people that had experience with spread spectrum from the military had moved into the commission, and they said, look, if we could get the commercial sector to use this technology, which the military is using for unjammable, undetectable communications, well, that would be the new spectrum paradigm, because we could basically introduce a service, and then if it failed, it wouldn't matter, because we wouldn't have this real estate model in place, and spectrum wouldn't be locked up. We could just allocate a new service right on top of it, because the nature of spread spectrum is that you can sort of do this magic thing called code division multiple access. So think of it as encryption. If you don't have the passcode, then you don't see the signal. Okay? That's a simple way of looking at spread spectrum, encryption. So the government proposed in 1981, the NOI stands for Notice of Inquiry, that's sort of FCC lingo. They put out this proposal to use spread spectrum from DC to daylight, the entire radio spectrum, with no power limits. That was the proposal. Think of it. That is really remarkable. That is a revolution. So what happened between 81 and 85 is a story that movies could be made of, but haven't, because they'd have to shoot you if you knew the facts. So that proposal got watered down into the spread spectrum rules that we see today, the Part 15 rules, the 1 watt and three little bands of spectrum. But it's important for you to realize the original proposal out of my government was the entire radio spectrum, no power limits. Okay? The political process short-circuited that. But look, here we are today, okay, of 20 years later, and you know, look what happened. Look at the Wi-Fi revolution. So, you know, the forces that were trying to kill this proposal were effective, but not in the way they thought. So there's always unintended consequences. So what happened when the rules came out, the Part 15 rules, was that equipment started to hit the market in 1987. And you saw the effects of this. These were data radios that were low speed at first, and then they got better and better and better. Other countries started to adopt these rules, and by the early 1990s, the IEEE .11, 802.11 committee formed, okay, to try to come up with a standard for wireless LANs. So the commission started allocating more spectrum for unlicensed, a service group created at the behest of Apple Computer called Unlicensed PCS. Okay, nothing really happened with this. Nobody really came out with any equipment for this, but it was another instance where more spectrum was allocated, in this case 20 megahertz for unlicensed services. Then we had the standard come out for 802.11, and then something happened called the Unlicensed National Information Infrastructure Band, the UNIBAN. This was an allocation of 300 megahertz in 1997, January 1997, for unlicensed. Okay? So, as Armin had said, there were these three little bands that came out of the 1985 rulemaking, but then the commission allocated an additional 300. Now, think about this. 300 megahertz was twice what cellular services had. So, we had an instance where the government was giving away free spectrum, not at auction, but for unlicensed devices. Okay? So, now unlicensed had a lot more spectrum than the licensed guys to do wireless data. Okay? So we saw Wi-Fi appear, that standard, and then something called SuperFi appears. Now, what I'm calling SuperFi here is what the people at this table are doing, which is enhanced Wi-Fi. And this includes proprietary radios also. So SuperFi is a compendium, and think of it an umbrella term for enhanced Wi-Fi and proprietary radios, which give people the ability to create end-user-owned infrastructure. Okay, then we have 802.11ag, and finally 802.16 appears. Now, I'm going to skip this because it's not really relevant, but I want to jump to amateur radio. Because remember my first premise there, first the technology appears, and then over time it becomes more accessible. Well, most of you probably don't know what happened with amateur radio. You probably heard of what ham radio or but you don't know the impact of it is on packet radio or Wi-Fi and all this other stuff, or SuperFi. So let me just talk about hams. I've been a ham since I was 12 years old, and I had a ham shack like this when I was a kid. But look, the point I want to make here is that as a teenager, I was basically used to being able to talk to anybody I wanted to in the world. Okay? So I was part of this communications web where I could basically, you know, do any, you know, just talk to anywhere in the world. Now, as I got older and the technology changed, that got from doing voice communications or Morse code to pushing bits. Okay? Pushing bits anywhere I wanted to in the world. Okay? So it's hard for you probably to conceive of this, but again, basically with the equipment that I had available to me, I could do this. Okay? And a lot of other people like me. So we formed a communications web or a culture of communications. Okay? So remember, first that premise, okay? As a technology, the impact doesn't appear until it becomes more accessible, okay? And that's what's sort of happening now with SuperFi. So we have hams at the North Pole, hams in space. You're probably not aware of this, but hams have their own satellite infrastructure that they put up, okay? So hams come in all ages, okay? So the lessons from the amateur radio service are these. Packet radio started in 1981, and it was based on early work funded by the U.S. government, the same work that funded the Internet, ARPA-DARPA, okay? So what you probably aren't aware of historically is that there were three paths. There was ARPANET, there was something called PRNET, Packet Radio Net, and there was something called SATNET, okay? SATNET never went anywhere. That was the Internet over satellite, or what... I'll just call it the Internet, but it was ARPANET over satellite. PRNET was ARPANET over radio, okay? And that program went for 20 years, and hardly anybody knows about it, but there were volumes of research done, and amateur radio people found out about this and adopted it and came out with a device that cost about $300 in the early 80s that you connected a radio to it and a computer, and you had a packet radio, okay? TNC, terminal node controller. Okay, and in that TNC was something called dynamic routing. Okay, so you could do mesh networking in the early 80s with radio. You see, so what I'm going to point out to you here is that there's really nothing new under the sun, and that we, for some reason, we don't look to the past and we keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. Okay, so you'll see how this develops as I move along. But by 1986, hams had developed hardware that did 56 kilobits over radio. Now think about that. It's hard to go back to 86, but at the time, 56 kilobits was blazing fast, okay? And it far exceeded what you could do in the commercial sector, okay? So, the hams put up global packet radio networks by 87 using two protocols, AX.25, that's amateur X25, and TCP/IP. And today these networks exist, still exist, okay, they cover the entire planet, and they're used a lot for emergency services. So like in 9/11 in New York, that network came into existence when the commercial infrastructure collapsed, amateur radio was there, okay, packet radio and all that stuff. So it's there, and so one point I want to make here is that whatever's going on, there's always something going on below your level of perception, okay? And the trick is learning how to see, okay? So what's happened over time is the bandwidth has increased as more interesting hardware has become available. Like where I live in Silicon Valley, there are amateur radio, packet radio networks that do amazing things that they just sit there quietly, people don't talk about them, they just use them. Okay, multi-megabit networks that cover the entire Bay Area. Okay, I have my own network. Basically, I have a network that covers the whole entire South Bay, which is the Silicon Valley part, and it does 20 megabits. So, as I said, I'm used to having this infrastructure. It's only when I leave home that I have to okay? But I have a 20 megabit link to the Internet, symmetric link to the Internet into my home. That's part of the infrastructure I have in place. Okay? So what happened is that, as I said, mesh networks were in place and metropolitan area networks were connected by the wired internet by 1995. And that hams had their own domain called ampr.org, okay? And that still exists today, all right? So You see, what people are going to be doing with SuperFi is doing the same sort of thing, okay? But it was done first in 95. So, all right, the conclusions for amateur radio is that wireless networks can be built in a cooperative manner where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We proved this, okay? And using spectrum as a commons can work through the use of some simple rules, and that when I have an amateur radio license, I have no other I can't get another ham to get off the spectrum, and we all have to share. And we've developed rules. Amateur radio has been around for almost 100 years now, and we've developed some rules of the road that work. Simple rules, okay? Self-policing and stuff like that. And that's what we're going to do with SuperFi. And the other thing, finally, is that innovation occurs when it's driven by needs, okay? Pure and simple. That's how. And so we have a framework here with unlicensed where we're seeing tremendous innovation that we don't see in the commercial sector where you don't see the needs driving that. Now, Wi-Fi arrives. And now you guys are the hams, okay? Everybody becomes a ham now because you're using this technology. You know, you don't have to have a license, and you just use it. You can concentrate on innovating. So what I want to do next is talk about some of the use of unlicensed in California, because we have a lot going on there. And think of California, we're like the sixth largest economy in the world, okay? Sixth largest economy in the world. And we also do crazy things like trying to be innovative, like with mandating electric cars be used and stuff like that, and then the Gigabit Initiative, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But what I want to do is talk about the HPREN project first. That's the High Performance Wireless Research and Education Network. We have a government body in the United States called the National Science Foundation. It funded the internet development, okay? Well, DARPA did, the Defense Department did, but then NSF took over and funded what became NSFNet, which became the commercial internet, not less than 10 years ago, okay? We're still not 10 years into the commercial internet yet until next year. So NSF funded the HPREN in 2000, and the goal was to come up with a high-performance network. And that, you've heard of Internet 2? Okay, well, that's the successor that we've developed to the regular internet that you guys use, and that the buy-in to get into Internet 2 is you've got to have a connection that's at least 45 megabits. Okay, so the people involved with HPREN were Internet 2 people, and the idea was to take off-the-shelf wireless devices, unlicensed wireless devices, and see if they could build an Internet 2 kind of network, okay? And essentially show the best practices involved with using Part 15 unlicensed gear. So look at what they've done. Look at that segment of California there, Southern California, that they cover now with an Internet 2 class of network. Look at all the connection points, okay? And this is people who are networking people that were not radio people, okay, that I said just took off-the-shelf equipment. So, again, where there's innovation, there are the needs. So they had the needs, and they innovated, okay? And they've shown that if you look at the commercial networks, this is a milestone that you guys should try to strive for, and that once you know something's possible, it makes all the difference in the world, okay? So look at this. So look at HPREN. Everything they've done is on their website. It's public, okay? A lot of good information here to learn how to do this stuff. Next, I want to focus on the SoCal FreeNet, Southern California FreeNet. This is a joint effort between the San Diego Wireless Users Group, Southern California Users Group, which is Pasadena, California, and the Orange County Wireless User Group. So what they've done, this is a volunteer effort, they've been able to create a coverage cloud that covers those parts of California, okay, with a FreeNet, all right? Again, another very interesting achievement, and what they're doing is that they're developing their own, how you say, open source, open hardware for this, okay? So that's one of their access boxes they developed. So they take, you know, off-the-shelf equipment, and they put it together, add their secret sauce, and voila, okay? So there's their website. Check that out. But this is a model, and you guys are doing it here too, but I'm just saying I'm focusing on California because it's something I have direct experience with, okay? So I don't want to talk about something that just, you know, is wishful thinking or something. So this is actually being done. And the point here is that once you get a municipal coverage cloud, okay, over a city. I mean, a cloud of coverage that covers the entire city. This isn't just playtime anymore. Because think about a commercial service like a cellular operator. It's like, that's the competition. You see, these kinds of free nets. Because once you have these free coverage crowds out, it's going to be very difficult for commercial carriers to make any money. Okay? One of the, McKinsey just released some information recently that they did some study of cellular users, and that most cellular calls are done by people who either stay put, don't move, or move at walking speed. 80%. So only 20% of the calls are done at mobile speeds, or car speeds. Okay? So it becomes clear now to you that it should be that these kind of networks can basically, you know, cover those 80% of those users, okay, with services. All right. SFLAN, moving up to Northern California. This is another community wireless network, but it has some service goals which are pretty, I think you should look at very carefully, in that they're saying that their network has to be symmetric, in that the upstream and the downstream have to be of equal speed, that the speed of the network has to be enough to do street DVD quality streaming video. Okay? DVD quality streaming video. And commercial, you know, there's no acceptable use rules. You can do anything. Anything goes. And you have distributed ownerships of the network. So this is in place now. They have a coverage cloud that covers the entire San Francisco. Okay? And they've just moved it over to Berkeley. All right? So basically, you go to their site, you put your address in, it'll tell you where to put an point an outside antenna to get to one of their coverage nodes. It's on a mountaintop somewhere. And that's it. And then you can sip bandwidth, and that's basically Brewster Kahle, who runs the Internet Archive, is making a Boku bandwidth available, okay, to this project, so that you can sip that bandwidth and then just redistribute it locally through your own local network. Okay, so that's what they're doing. Now, the Bay Area Wireless Research Network is a sister group to SFLAN. And think of this as the R&D arm. So basically, they're like in the SoCal land, they basically do all of it together in one group. And up in Northern California, in the San Francisco Bay Area, they basically have a group that runs the network, and they have a group that does the R&D for the hardware and software that's being used by the network. Okay, so another place to look at for best practices. So the interesting thing here is that all this information is, again, open source, open hardware, and is freely available so that anybody around the world can tap into this stuff and use it. But what you see here are best practice existence proofs for freenets, wireless freenets. Now, Bay Area Network Coordination. One of the things that's happened in the Bay Area is that we have a lot of wireless ISPs, and what they've done is formed a coordination group. So this is the first one of these that I think about happened in the United States, formed in early 2003. It only coordinates the 5 gigahertz band and not 2.4. Now, the reason that's done is that it's not that 2.4 isn't used by the commercial wireless ISPs, is that they use it to deliver service to their end users, okay? And they use 5 gigahertz for backbone, all right? And so basically, without coordination, it would be chaos. It is chaos now, but basically, this has been working, and nobody's killed anybody yet, okay? So it's a model to look at for how to handle this kind of thing in the way that amateur radio has, by self-policing. Okay, the arrival of municipal infrastructure. Well, as I said, when you get these Wi-Fi or SuperFi clouds that are starting to be built over cities, we're seeing lots of cities now. Atlanta is going to do a cloud, okay? It won't be free, but it'll be a cloud, okay? We have a number of cities in California that have put up their own clouds already. So they're either privately owned or publicly owned. It's El Cerritos, California. But anyway, the site I've put down here is a good website that tracks a lot of this municipal wireless deployment. So this is the wave now, and it's going to start building, okay? Okay, because again, once you cover a city, it's not just popsicles anymore. This is the real deal. So let me talk about gigabit or bus. Back in 1961, JFK basically gave a speech where he says, you know, we're going to go to the moon by the end of the decade. All right? We did. Okay. And I mean, but think about it. People at times says, what is he smoking? You know, how are we going to do this? Why are we going to the moon? You know, whatever. Okay. Well, in California, we've done it again, basically, with the electric car thing. Now we said that, look, we're going to bring gigabit connectivity to everybody in the state. So this is our vision. Okay, we may fail, but we don't think we will. So we've got the best technologists in the state to sell this thing. And so it's run by an organization called CNIC, which is the Corporation for Educational Networking Initiatives in California. CNIC runs the state educational networks, okay? The University of California system, all that stuff, all right? So we're going to do this both using wired and wireless. Now, the best bet right now is that because of incumbency issues and politics and stuff, that wireless is probably going to be the way we do this by 2010, okay? And that the idea is that you should be able to walk out your front door and sip a gigabit. Now, the reason we're setting a gigabit as the goal is that look at a lot of your PCs today. A lot of your PCs today have built-in gigabit Ethernet interfaces, okay? I mean, gigabit Ethernet is consumer price now. It's cheap, all right? So, but look at what you're getting from the commercial broadband carriers. You're not getting anywhere close to a gigabit. So you're basically connecting your computer into a network that's running at snail speed, okay? So we realize that this just isn't going to work anymore, and that to run the kind of applications that we're seeing being run on Internet too, okay, we've got to give better bandwidth, more bandwidth to the end user, okay? So this is our way of doing it, all right? So I'm in charge of the wireless task force for the initiative, and it's my goal to make this happen. So we've got 6 years basically to do this, and I assure you there will be gigabit radios by 2010 that are as cheap as Wi-Fi radios are today. The technology is not the obstacle here. The obstacles are political, period, okay? And that we're talking about changing paradigms here, and what the FCC faced back in 1981 is nothing like the battle that's going to take place here as we try to move to a gigabit, all right? So my last point here, a gigabit is not a technology. It's about capacity. It's delivering capacity to you, the end user, to do whatever you want to do. So we have a four-phase program. We're in the third phase now, which is the phase where we try to figure out how in the hell we're going to do this. The Access to Broadband campaign in the UK has sort of adopted this gigabit initiative also. Okay, sounds good. But January 1st of next year, we start the implementation phase. Okay? So this is the real deal here. All right? We already have some towns in California that are delivering gigabit to the end user. So we have this thing called the On the Road to the Gigabit Award Program. It was started in 2003. My company won the first award for innovation. It was for a project that was basically we took a utility company that delivers electricity and power in Northern California, and we got them to, okay, basically this is turn off their licensed microwave system and unused unlicensed radio for critical infrastructure. So this was a milestone. Think about it. A power company using unlicensed radio for critical infrastructure communications. So there you see their 8-foot dish that was replaced by this little unlicensed radio that goes over the same path and costs 1/100th of the cost of that licensed microwave system. Okay? So the economics were what convinced this power company to do it, and also the testing to show the reliability was there. Okay? So, and there is another shot of that. Look at the difference this is just sort of like 10 years of technology. Okay? Size matters. No. This is 20. Well, this microwave system, that was T1, and so it's been replaced by a system that is 20, okay, for 1/100th of cost. All right, so the unlicensed wireless conclusions are that, just like amateur radio, you can build these networks in a cooperative fashion. You guys are doing it, okay? Spectrum is a commons can work, okay? It was pointed out by the previous speaker. And innovation drives needs. So, tomorrow, what we need, we're at the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers' first flight, okay? Wireless needs that same kind of first flight event. So to get in the air, we need to recapture the bold thinking the FCC had in 1981, and that, again, this is politics, okay? We can't afford to let politics get in the way of innovation. That's what this whole conference here is about, All right. We need to move to a new model of spectrum allocation and management, which is known as open spectrum. The previous speaker called it free spectrum, but I call it open spectrum. All right. And we need to develop and deploy something called cognitive radios. Now, I could talk for a day on cognitive radios alone. You probably don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But remember HAL 9000 in the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey? That was a cognitive machine. Okay. Basically, a cognitive radio will understand and act like a person would in terms of how it uses a spectrum. What the FCC has a rulemaking right now for cognitive radios. And the rulemaking is about decentralizing the regulatory authority into the device. This is paradigm shifting stuff in that it's going to put the regulatory authority away from the government into the device itself. Okay? This is what this whole thing here is about, the digital commons. It's about that kind of freedom. And it's that you people, open source, open hardware, are going to be the ones that develop cognitive radios, not the commercial sector. All right? So the idea is to get fast bits anywhere, anytime. So how much bandwidth is enough? Well, a friend of mine, Tom Freeberg, who was a chief strategist or futurist at Motorola, formed a task force in 2000 that looked at what it would take to build a working Star Trek-like transporter. I mean, this was serious research effort. And his task force came up with the notion that we could do this by projecting ahead technology 2070. Okay? Now, he since amended that this month. I attended a talk he gave to 2053, and this was based on the Internet and how fast the Internet's growing. 2053. So we're 50 years from a Star Trek transporter. Now, I think that should help put the gigabit initiative in some perspective, okay? And if we get to a gigabit by 2010, okay, then the holodeck would be the first step. And that I'm saying 40 gigabits is reality. And that if you got 40 gigabits, you can essentially simulate reality. All right? Think about it. Well, in the United States, we've just started a project, okay, $100 million five-year effort called the National Lambda Rail, which is the successor to Internet 2, which is to build a transcontinental 40 gigabit network. Because, again, think about it. What is the 1 gigabit California network going to feed into for an internet backbone? Well, we're building it, okay? And it's the National Lambda Rail, all right? So 40 gigabits reality. So there's the early holodeck from it's a picture from Star Trek. But think about it, all right? So the transporter is really just more bits. And then here's an early transporter. And then the Mark II from the next generation Star Trek. Okay? But after we do the gigabit in 2010, the next step will be the transporter or bust. Thank you very much.